you need social channels now. You need your Instagram, you need your Twitter, you need your Facebook. It's how people find you. It's how people assess you. It's kind of, it's your chance to basically put yourself on the map.
Hello and welcome to BrandTuned, the only podcast on branding, which includes related disciplines like intellectual property that are fundamental to growing a brand. I'm Shireen Smith, lawyer, brand strategist, and curious business owner, keen to discover what moves the needle in branding. My guest today is Alex Bodini, the co-founder of London-based social media agency Spin Brands. Alex has worked in digital marketing and social media for nearly a decade, working with both the likes of Google and eBay, as well as with hundreds of small businesses in the UK and Europe.
Hello, and thank you for having me.
So, five businesses. Can you tell us a little more about your background and how you come to be involved in five businesses?
For sure. Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, I suppose it's got to the point now where I often wonder kind of how I managed to kind of get to this point as well. Five businesses does sound, it's probably overstating it and overcomplicating it a little bit. I mean, briefly, kind of after university, sort of studying business management and doing the kind of relatively standard path there, I started working in a leading digital marketing agency in London, in central London, worked on some huge clients, loved that, learned a lot from it, and really learned, I guess, my first core trade, which was digital marketing. But from that, from then, which I guess I left there when I was maybe 24, 25, it's always been a case of kind of entrepreneurial nature starting things since then. So straight away after that, I started a little bike company, kind of a sort of single speed push bike type company, which I loved. And then since then, I've now involved with a number of different businesses. I've got one kind of core business, which to an extent is my day job. And I suppose the rest of my time I use starting businesses with partners or on my own, almost as a hobby to a certain extent, because it's just what I enjoy doing.
So you're quite the entrepreneur. When did you actually start your social media agency? It's called Spin Brands, is that right?
Absolutely, yeah. So that started in 2016, about February 2016. I think we were officially trading from March 2016, so 4.5 years ago now.
What was it like at the beginning? You'd obviously experienced business before, but did you have any challenges?
For sure. We definitely did have challenges, and it definitely wasn't easy. At the same time, things clicked into place with that business very early on. And that was something which I really have learned from. Having kind of worked really, really hard in the bike space, and I felt like I was pushing the accelerator as fast as I possibly could, working really, really hard for very minimal movement, very minimal kind of speed picked up. Whereas when it came to Spin Brands and I met my business partner, we started it together, we just immediately felt traction. The numbers started working kind of in our favor early on. People liked what we offered. We found it easy to open doors. We found people were very happy to talk to us and quite keen to sort of sign up with us in terms of what we did back then. So I'd say the sort of the early traction really felt very, very strong. And I was able, having learnt from my previous agency, the one that I worked for, I learned a lot about what worked and what didn't work, which definitely gave me a major leg up as well.
Right. So what sort of clients did you attract initially?
Initially, it was really sort of genuinely sort of small, I suppose, without sounding patronizing, kind of micro businesses. Which is something we believe in. At the end of the day, we often say, and it's a little bit cheesy, but we're almost business people who do marketing rather than marketing people who do marketing, if that makes sense. We love starting businesses. We love understanding people's stories, people's motivations, people's reasons for doing things. We really buy into things. And these sort of the first few clients were, I suppose you can call them kind of kitchen table businesses, whatever you want to call them, kind of people who are starting things, often side hustles, often kind of people who are maybe, for example, on maternity leave and things like that, were sort of starting businesses, and we would help them kind of get off the ground, help them build a bit of a footprint, and ultimately help them kind of navigate the world of social, which I guess, is a huge opportunity for a small business, but it also can be pretty daunting in terms of the space to get into.
Yeah, a lot of those sort of businesses wouldn't be able to afford much. So what did you actually offer them?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's a good question. And without sounding mean, there's a reason why we are no longer really able to work with those kind of businesses, because it is a tricky one as a kind of a professional entity, professional agency. It is hard to work alongside those kind of smaller kind of often people paying out their personal pockets kind of clients, because they do their budgets are limited and they do want results here and now, and often with marketing that's not kind of the way it goes. So it definitely is a challenge, and we would typically do a sort of basic social media management service where we would say, look, you need social channels now, you need your Instagram, you need your Twitter, you need your Facebook. It's how people find you, it's how people assess you, it's your chance to basically put yourself on the map. And then through, I guess, a number of systems and kind of ways of doing things, we were able to sort of churn out a decent enough product that people felt like they were getting a voice without us necessarily having to spend too much time that would make it uneconomical, I suppose.
Did they create the content for you, or did you create it for them?
I suppose it depended. Some people were quite good at content creation. They're constantly doing photo shoots or creating different types of content. Some people did none. For example, we worked with a few early stage apps and they didn't really have any content other than screenshots. So it was our job to kind of assess kind of the bits of the jigsaw that we had. It might be some images that they have now, it might be some old images they have in their archive, it might be sort of general kind of publicly available imagery that could work and could be edited and used, it might be user generated content, and we figure out kind of what pieces we have and we kind of throw it together. And our goal was always just to make sure that we create a very followable, very interesting set of feeds that their target customer would likely enjoy. So that was always the end goal. We started with that end goal in mind and kind of worked back from there.
So your focus must have been Instagram then, if there was so much imagery, is that right?
No, you're absolutely right. It was we often sold kind of three channels as part of a package, normally Instagram, Facebook and Twitter, but we've still to this day find that 80% of our clients' attention is probably on Instagram. That's the one they talk about. It's the one the numbers they look at. It's the feed they care about. It's the bit of the report they listen to. It's really where a lot of the attention goes, because it seems to be, I guess we've maybe got our timing right with that one. It was really on the rise and becoming more and more important in those early days.
Right. So what sort of clients did you then move on to after you got going?
Yeah, sure. So I guess it's almost like we describe it as like a bit of a natural totem pole. Like you can't just get yourself straight to the top unless maybe you've worked in the industry for 15, 20 years in a very reputable space and you almost go and create your own shop with some of your maybe existing clients. But if you're starting from the bottom, to an extent, you do have kind of a feeling of imposter syndrome. No one knows who you are. No one knows if you're any good. So we have to kind of start from the bottom and work our way up. And probably that step sort of two, step three tended to be a bit more kind of professional companies. Maybe they've been established for a couple of years. We had a couple of B2B clients and a couple of kind of businesses where, yeah, maybe there was two or three people working there. They were starting to understand kind of what they were about. And we often used to pick up a couple of clients through a platform called Crowdcube, which is a kind of in equity investment funding platform. And we picked up those kind of slightly smaller stage companies from there. And then that journey kind of bit by bit has continued to the point where 4 years later, we now work with a range of sort of scale-up brands, high-growth scale-up brands, as well as a few kind of household names.
So what was your experience of creating your own brand? How did that pan out?
Yeah, the reason we're called Spin Brands was originally we were, both myself and my business partner, Max, worked in the sort of bicycle industry. That's kind of how we met. We were both in that space. And so we originally wanted to sort of take our offering to bicycle clients. So a few of those kind of kitchen table smaller businesses were in the bicycle space. We called ourselves Spin because it kind of made sense. And there was always a bit of confusion because some people thought of Spin, they thought of like spin doctors and kind of like a few slightly negative conversations there. Mm-hmm. But we managed to kind of ride through that, and it never became a big problem. And we probably had two or three kind of mini rebrands over our time. And I suppose the way I see it is kind of as you kind of work your way up through that from the ground up, you need to kind of bring up everything about your business in line with the kind of the level of work that you're doing. So we had to improve everything from our invoicing and our finances through to our team and our hiring through to our training. And the brand was something we had to continuously iterate and ensure that ultimately it matched and spoke to the kind of target marketplace, kind of client that we were aiming for.
So by the brand, you didn't change the name. Presumably you don't mean the logo and things, but more the substance.
We actually are even only in 4 years, we are on our third logo. So this logo we've had it for about 18 months now. We're very happy with it. That was much more of a comprehensive project because before it was probably a little bit like kind of we worked with a young designer who was at university at the time, and he kind of spat out a number of concepts and we kind of just went with something that worked at the time. And we're much more mature now in that kind of sense.
What about things like your mission and values? Did you also sit down and think those through?
Eventually, yes, absolutely. So when we kind of created our identity now, when we kind of created a new logo, we turned pink, we worked on our kind of strap lines and things like that, it was really, really was thought through. We went away actually with the entire team at the time, which was about 12 people, mm-hmm. on an away day. And we did like a number of these kind of models where we're trying to figure out kind of what are the features, what are the benefits of what we are, what we stand for. In terms of who our competitors are, we went through their websites and we started to try to think, what's your immediate impression of these guys? Who do they serve? What are they about? And kind of we started to identify really the kind of the best window dressing that we wanted to show. So it was a much more considered, kind of careful thinking process in the end to kind of create this set of missions, propositions, kind of values that we have now.
Are you using them to guide your business journey?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, yes, we certainly are. I mean, in terms of kind of our core mission, that's certainly something which is stuck. And again, we probably had a few failed attempts because you often write something down, you think it sounds good, and it just sort of doesn't really stick. It sort of fades away. Whereas we started focusing on kind of the idea that it was our goal to build scale in businesses that we believe in. And once we kind of got that, we're like, okay, scale is our thing. We really realized that scale was what we ultimately offered the market. So we changed a lot of our kind of positioning and our terminology around that scale. And then the businesses we believe in kind of came around this point where we were starting to get a good reputation. We were starting to be able to pick and choose who we wanted to work with. And really, we don't have a particular sector we wanted to focus on. We don't have a particular size of business we wanted to focus on. And we're not kind of purely in the kind of social, socially conscious space. But we knew we had our boundaries. We knew we had our lines. So we kind of thought that the business that we believe in was quite a nice kind of a way of allowing ourselves permission to work with a number of different businesses.
Okay, I wondered if you specialize in the clothing and fashion sector, given that you've got various fingers in such businesses, fingers in those sort of pies, so to speak.
Yeah, I'd say we certainly, I suppose, over-index in kind of the sort of challenger business models. So I suppose overall, it's kind of the e-commerce, direct consumer, consumer goods, that kind of thing tends to work well. So I suppose if I were to describe our most typical, very kind of perfect kind of client relationship would be a brand in the kind of, let's say, fitness or outerwear or shoes or some sort of space like that. They've got a product, they've got a physical product they sell to the market for maybe 100 to 200 pounds, which is a bit of an e-commerce sweet spot. They've proven their model, they know their margins, they know what they're about. They've got kind of loyal fans and a good product, and we help them basically achieve scale. We help them achieve scale in terms of their digital footprint, their online presence, their social media branding, but we also then help them drive their online revenue. So that's probably why a number of the other businesses have kind of come off the back of those kind of sectors.
So what sort of services do you offer them?
We do three things, really. We decided to focus on, again, it's about messaging, it's about brand. We found that there's a lot of, in our space, generalist agencies where they do a little bit of everything. Whereas we wanted to be, and we often use the phrase pure play social media, mainly because, well, I guess two core reasons. Firstly, it meant that we could get better and better at doing what we did. If we only did three things, we did them very, very well, then people would be very kind of happy with the service. And also in terms of kind of word of mouth and being known for something, we find there's not that many good social agencies out there. So often the most casual conversation we'll have with someone, either a networking event or a prospective client, whatever it might be, they often sort of remember us. And then at some point in the next 6 months, 12 months, sometimes 2 years down the line, people remember, oh yeah, social media. I met some guys once who do that and they do it really well. And I think it kind of allowed us to carve out a bit of a reputation and a niche in a certain space, as opposed to being just a generalist kind of digital type company.
So you said you provide three services. What are they?
Organic social management, so basically taking on the social media channels on behalf of a business and creating content, curating content, basically building a really great set of profiles that really speak to a brand, kind of build up the community, build up the engagement, and basically make the brand look as good as possible in that kind of long-term brand building space. Second one is paid social media, so using targeted advertising on Instagram, on Twitter, on Facebook, to drive a specific action in mind. So normally that's e-commerce and normally that's sales. So we call it performance marketing. It's our goal is if you spend £10,000 on advertising, we want to maximize the return. We want to get you £50,000 of sales or £100,000 of sales. So a kind of paid social performance marketing. And then the third thing is the what we call ambassador marketing, which is kind of more commonly called influencer marketing in our space. But we tend to find influencer marketing to many people has become a kind of someone has their 5 minutes of fame. They've been on reality TV for a little bit and they basically want to kind of represent the highest bidder in no matter what that product might be. Whereas ambassador marketing is a way of getting people with genuine reach, genuine followers and genuine community to kind of get on board with your brand and help promote it because they believe in that brand more than someone else.
If they need a new website or a new visual look, how do you help them with that?
So we know what we can do well and we know what we can't do well. And I suppose it's never been in our interest, so, especially in the early days, it's tempting because you want to be greedy. If someone's got money on the table for something, you want to be able to be like, yeah, we'll do that, no problem. And we probably did do that once or twice and we realised that long term it just didn't work out. So we do have preferred partners that we would use. For things like website builds, and we know Shopify experts, WordPress experts, Magento experts who we would bring in as to what their sort of needs were. However, we do have an internal design team. So populated amongst the organic social, the paid social and the ambassadors, we have our in-house design team who are there to ultimately they're very skilled creatives who can do a range of different things, and they also can help with that kind of visual brand identity type of thing. So they did our rebrand internally because they're just they can turn their hand to everything and they tend to understand what people are looking for when it comes to the modern day brand.
Oh, right. So they could provide branding for your clients.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Because we tend to find it's understanding brand, understanding kind of all elements of brand is a huge part of kind of what we do when it comes to social. So organic social, especially when we're trying to really represent what that brand's about. So some people are very clear. Some people come to us with a clear set of brand guidelines. They know exactly what they want to be. They know who they are and what the kind of who they're speaking to. Whereas a lot of brands kind of come to us a little bit kind of confused and not sure what to do about things and not quite sure who they are. So whilst we rarely go in and do a complete rebrand, i.e. say, right, we think you should be predominantly green instead of red, we think you should change your logo and maybe even change your name, that's beyond our remit, however, or beyond our desire, really. However, certainly in terms of rebranding, kind of what a look and feel of a company is a huge part of what we do. We're often involved with the rewriting of websites. We're often involved with kind of ultimately figuring out what their core messaging is, and then using social as a mouthpiece for that.
So you've got content creators internally as well, do you?
Correct. Yes, exactly. Yeah. And most forms of content we can kind of cover. So whether it's written content, visual content, animated content, it's our kind of, I guess, our job to make kind of amazing assets out of the kind of limited resources that we do have.
Great. So do you have a long tie-in in terms of your contract? Do they have to commit for a long time?
Sometimes, yes. It depends on the nature of the relationship. And again, it's kind of something we've had to earn over time. So at first, I mean, it was very much like kind of pick us up and drop us down as and when, as you wish, because we had to just lower the barriers to getting started with us. But now that we've got a bit of a reputation, we've got more demand than we can supply, it means we can be a little bit more choosy. And ultimately, we want our team, and we want to be able to fully commit to work, knowing that we've got 12 months to do it. So typically, we have a 3-month kind of break clause at the moment, but it kind of does depend on the relationship with the client and what they need.
Yeah, I guess a lot of the work must be front-loaded if you're creating thumbnails and various visuals to use for their social media. You don't want them suddenly going off.
Well, exactly. That's the thing. And especially when it comes to paid social, a lot of the work up front is doing the research, building the campaigns, understanding the personas we're trying to target and building that initial structure. And yeah, I suppose you learn through your mistakes. And we probably a few times we've gone all guns blazing. We've done an amazing job in month one. They've paid their minimal retainer, and then they've said, great, well, kind of that's ours now, and they can move us off, and they can in theory start to try to have a go at it themselves, which is a very dangerous space to be in, and ultimately gives away our kind of our IP and our approach. So we definitely avoid that where possible now.
So what sort of size clients are they then that they could do their own?
Yeah, I suppose, I mean, it's one of those things where what we do, social media marketing, it's not on the surface especially complicated. So especially when it comes to social media management, to a lesser extent paid social media management, but people kind of think, oh yeah, I can figure this out myself. I mean, the platforms are self-serve, everyone has access to the same tools. So sometimes, and we have been in a situation before where clients kind of decide they want to take it in-house, and we'll go, okay, we'll reluctantly accept that. And then 3 months later, we can see it's completely declined. Their levels have really started to kind of get sloppy. The visual look isn't there. The copy tone isn't there. The engagement's plummeting, and they kind of knock back on the door and say, "Look, we thought we could do it, but we made a bit of a mess of it. Can you kind of repair this for us?" So, it's one of those things, and probably the bigger the business, the bigger the business, the more they respect us and what we do. They understand that we're experts, and they tend to understand that they're going to a social agency like us to handle X, Y, and Z, because they know that we've got that in-house expertise. Often is the smaller business who thinks they can get away with it themselves. And I understand there's needs must and everyone has a budget, but that's more than often the case.
So what do you do to get engagement for them?
In terms of on the social channels for our clients?
Yeah.
It's a whole mix of things, really. I mean, we have kind of a framework, if you like, of what people ultimately resonate with. I mean, one of the biggest mistakes people do is they think social media, they think it's just another space to plaster your products, almost like a notice board of, here's our product, we do this, we do that, we've got a discount on, and that's not what it's about. It's much more, it's a two-way conversation. It's much more about ultimately providing value to their day, providing value to their feed. They're choosing to engage with you, they're choosing to follow you. So we have our kind of six core kind of content areas that we tend to focus on, which in the end tends to give a much more rounded kind of view of a brand. And it's everything from kind of discovering the brand story to understanding the product to understanding what kind of opinions this brand has. It's about being reactive to topical events and things that are happening in this kind of, in this way that ultimately makes sense to that brand, and all these different things. So we find that by kind of ensuring that we're posting different types of content that ultimately say the same kind of message or sing from the same hymn sheet, that creates a feed that people actually want to follow and actually want to kind of check in with, rather than purely just a here's a new shoe, here's a new shoelace, here's a new shoe, which people don't really want to follow or engage with.
Mm. I find that a number of people who would become our clients are not the sort of people who would go around liking things, say on LinkedIn or wherever, but they do notice my content. So really, I'm wondering if you actually look for likes as a measure of engagement or comments.
Yeah, no, it's a very good point. And to be honest, overall propensity to like is going down. It is just, I mean, people are following more things. People are just, ultimately, people are tapping the like button less. And to a lot of people, it's kind of a sign of success. It's like, how many likes did we get? How many comments did we get? And we all often focus on that engagement rate, which is different ways of calculating it. But typically it's just how many followers have you got? How many people like the average post? And we can kind of get a sense of what the benchmarks are. But you're completely right in terms of the vast majority of people, they might be consuming content. They might really engage the content. They might read every piece twice over, but they might not like it. They might not comment it and they might not share it. So we have to kind of ensure that we are looking at the whole spectrum of events, and we are looking at ultimately everything from follower numbers to reach to engagement to and then kind of clicks and then further kind of engagement further down the funnel. So yeah, you're definitely right to suggest that kind of it's a lot of the work that we do, or a lot of the value that we add, is ultimately unseen by numbers and metrics.
And finally, which brand do you particularly admire, Alex?
That's a very good question. I really admire brands that are open with who they are and open to what they kind of stand for. I mean, sort of naming one that I've kind of always admired for a while is a company called Karma Drinks, kind of previously Karma Cola, now Karma Drinks. And they're a challenger brand to sort of the likes of Coca-Cola, which obviously is a huge giant to try and take on. Mm-hmm. And I suppose, whereas Coca-Cola might be the traditional black box brand where you don't really know what happens behind the scenes. You don't know what they're about. You don't know their recipe. You don't know anything about kind of like their corporation, whether they're shady, what their production chain looks like. You don't know anything about them. Whereas something like Karma Cola, they've done this modern approach of kind of glass box brand where they're very, very open. They tell you where they get their cola nuts. They tell you everything about their mission. They tell you all about their production. They tell you very, very clearly what the ingredients are, and people really respond to that. People care about that. Yes, they charge a fair bit more than a can of kind of Coca-Cola, but people really believe in that, and people therefore attach themselves. And it's one of those things, it's always much better to have kind of 1,000 true fans who really believe in what you do. So I admire brands who are brave enough to kind of have that glass box approach and ultimately show what their insides look like.
So how do you spell their name? I must look them up.
Karma, so K-A-R-M-A. So kind of Karma.
Okay, like Karma.
Exactly, yeah, Karma Drinks, like that. And yeah, really, really great business, doing really great things and with a very good conscience about them as well.
How long have they been going?
I believe they started in New Zealand maybe 8 years ago, and they've been in the UK for 3 or 4 years. And yeah, like every business, they've had their ups and downs, but they seem to be, their footprint seems to be growing.
I'll look at them. So thank you very much indeed, Alex, for appearing on the podcast.
Pleasure. Thanks very much for having me.
My guest next week is Dominic Wells of OnFolio. He has been building, buying and selling content websites since 2012, and also helps others do the same. If you've listened to the podcast to this point, please do like, share, or rate it. If you have an important message to share that would be relevant to listeners, then do connect with me and let me know. You can find me on most platforms, but perhaps the best one to use is LinkedIn.